So, yeah, as I began to work through all these details, the Lord just kept showing me that it's about His providence. And that's why I'm here this morning, is because I felt God's prompting. It's time to share it again. You know, I was like, well, some people have already heard it and this and that and whatever. And even this morning, you know, when you share your testimony, you know, you kind of start to see the spiritual battle is real. That's when Satan comes and he tries, like even this morning, it's, you know, got some, you know, like notification, oh, I'm not going to be able to make it. I'm not going to be able to make it. And you know, you hear this thing in the background says, no, nobody cares. Just keep it to yourself. It's not a big deal. And so anyway, I had to fight against that, and I did. And well, the Lord is always stronger than the devil is, but we have to fight against those things that we hear in our minds that try to distract us from doing what we're called to do. So anyway, I want to start with Proverbs 16:9. I want that, he'll have that up on the screen. I assume the recording's already going, right? So Proverbs 16:9 says, a man's heart plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. So basically you can do what you want, but God is ultimately directing your steps. You know, anyway, that's a tangent. I'm not going on that one. So anyway, hopefully the details all make sense. My parents were divorced when I was 4 years old, and that's when my mom started drinking, and problems with alcohol started at that time. And my mom and my sister and I lived with my mom in Danville, and my grandma, I spent a lot of time with her. She watched us a bulk of the time because my mom had to work, you know, all kinds of shifts at Arby's. I had a whole lot of anger issues, much worse than what you guys have probably seen now. Some people that knew my past had seen my anger. I'm sure Aaron's probably seen that one quite a few times. So I went through counseling to try to get help, and that never really helped with those anger issues. I was held back in kindergarten, but my mom, of course, told me, oh, kids do a lot better when they're held back in kindergarten. But she kind of explained that as the reason why they're holding me back, so I'd do even better. Which I'm not sure if it helped or not, but anyway. So along lines with all those anger issues, in first grade, my mom got a phone call that her son had either thrown scissors or stabbed a kid in the leg with scissors. And of course, they started questioning everything that was going on at home. They were trying to figure out, you know, what is the kid learning if he's doing something like that? So in one way, I guess that's God's providence, because they start making scissors with rounded tips after that, protect the kids. So, and I really don't have a lot of memories from my childhood. A lot of those are either blocked or from drug use. Didn't really get to. I think sometimes here and there some things come back, but. So I remember some of my earlier memories. I was about 6 years old, and I was having stomach pains and just felt sick, and, you know, nobody knew what was going on. So my mom and my grandma had taken me to the doctor, and I had, they started on me on some antibiotics. Well, it didn't really get any better, and nobody really knew what was going on. So one morning, my dad showed up at my grandma's house and picked me up, and he the night before, he'd had a dream that my appendix had burst. So he took me to the clinic. They did blood tests, and they found some of the poison from the appendix in my bloodstream. So they hurried up, rushed me over to the hospital, and had immediate surgery. I didn't really know that at the time, but later, this last few weeks, when I was talking to my dad, the doctor said I was about 6 to 8 hours from dying. You know, obviously this is, God used a dream for his providence, and I had way more than what I'm testifying of today. I had lots of dreams about things. I mean, I got to, like, I even had dreams of places that I went to later on in life, and I never really understood the whole meaning of it all, but, so growing up, I didn't get to see a lot of my dad. So I think that caused some of my anger issues, because I know my mom said there was a lot of meltdowns that I had back then. And just from all the stuff that was going on, yeah, not too much about his life, but he was a biker, and he was into coke and rode with the local biker gang. So he didn't join them, but he rode with them much of the time, and so I'm sure there was a lot of benefits that he found in that situation. We didn't get to see him all the time, I still knew that he loved me. So that wasn't really it's a comfort that I still carry with me, knowing that he still loved me. So once I started elementary school, I went to Douglas, and I had about three friends at the time, and so three decent friends, and also I spent a lot of time writing extra sentences and learning words from the dictionary. So you could say I was a bit of an overachiever. Teachers thought maybe it would help. And then I still remember, even at the age of 9 years old, I remember laying in my bed at home, and I wanted to kill myself. I had no idea. I felt alone, of course. But I was scared, and I always thought that basically death would be like me being trapped in a coffin forever, for the rest of my life. And so that scared me. And so I basically found other ways to deal with life. Not in a good way. So I, you know, obviously didn't pursue it because I'm here this morning. So then when I got started in junior high at Southview in Danville, I pretty much lost those friends. All the ones, they pretty much turned on me and just kind of jumped in on the bandwagon with everybody else. Always making fun of my clothes, what I look like, and getting kicked and hit in the hallways. And I just, every day I dreaded going to school. I was just sick to my stomach every day. And now I realize it was anxiety later on in life. But you know, of course, when you deal with a lot of anger issues or anxiety issues, you deal with anger issues, because anxiety and depression they go together. So a lot of times, maybe it's a good idea to figure out, you know, if you've got some anger issues, maybe there's something that you're anxious about. But anyway. So about 11 years old, I started going through all the cabinets and everything that I could at home. I don't know if I was nosy or what, but I just loved going through things. And I found some caffeine pills, so I started taking those. And they had expired, I don't know, like several years earlier, but didn't stop me from taking them. And so I ended up taking some of them with me to school. I'm not sure exactly why, but so I had them in my pocket, and then I was sitting down for lunch, and there were some kids. They threw a lighter underneath my seat and hollered out that I had a lighter in school, and so I freaked out. And so I was like, I tried to find somebody. So I gave the pills to somebody, one of the kids in my class, to, you know, try to keep from getting in trouble, because I figured they were going to come searching me. Well, they never actually did, but the kid, he did tell on me. He told the teacher, which was the right thing to do. So that was the first year that I got kicked out of school. And basically it started a trend that I was kicked out at least once every year for, you know, until my senior year in high school. Definitely not in college. So about sixth or seventh grade, I remember there was a kid named Adam at school. Everybody loved him. He was just one of those kids that, I mean, he was just nice to everybody. Everybody got along with him really well. And one of the friends that I'd been hanging out with, one of the kids that was my friend in junior high but kind of turned back on me in high school or junior high had given me a call and said that the kid had, that he had died. So I didn't believe him. I just figured this is just another way. They're just trying to get back at me, just trying to do anything they can to pick on me. So when I got to school the next day, I'd found out that he was out for a track meet, and he was running next to the pool, and he fell and hit his head, and he was dead before he even hit the water. And basically, since I didn't believe them, they spread the rumor that I was glad that he had died. And of course, you know, what kids are going to take that well, especially a kid that everybody really liked. And so that kind of ruined a lot of my chances of really getting any other friends that year. And I was scared and angry all at the same time. I just went into the classroom. I started throwing chairs and tables and everything. And I don't remember if I just remember my mom had to come pick me up from school. And so I do remember laying in bed and just remembering her just sitting there with me. And, you know, I have no idea what she said, but it was comforting. It was what I needed. So one thing that to think about too is it's not always what you can say to somebody that's hurting. A lot of times it's even if you can just sit there with them. You know, it doesn't matter who they are. And I think a lot of times, like yesterday, I was looking back. I started trying to look for one of my bad pictures to put up, but I couldn't really find one. So maybe that's a good excuse. But I mean, I had smiles in so many of my pictures. But, you know, you don't know what kids are going through sometimes. You know, kids hurt. And a lot of times they won't tell anybody because they don't know what to expect. They don't, you know, maybe it's just, you know, maybe they hear those same voices. Oh, they don't care. Nobody's going to help you. You just got to figure it out for yourself. So, but anyway, God designed us for community. You know, and I think too very often we get so focused on me, my life, what I'm going through, that we fail to see what other people are going through. You know, especially children, sometimes it could be really, like I said, can really be overlooked because you see them happy, they're playing and all this other stuff, you know. But sometimes the truth is there's much more pain going on beneath the surface than what you can see. So anyway, in eighth grade, I had a couple of girlfriends, or friends that were girls, not girlfriends. One of them had stolen some caffeine pills from the store the night before, and so we split, between three of us, we split the bottle of 30 pills. So I remember sitting in class, and, you know, and anyway, they called me to the office. I already knew what had happened. I already knew we were busted. And so they called my mom. She was on her way, and they were questioning me because they wanted to find out how many pills each of us took, because one of them had overdosed and had to have her stomach pumped. I mean, she did pull through. She made it okay. But so then later, I don't even know who left it there, but at some point I found a coffee can in the garage. I had a whole bunch of remnants from, you know, whoever smoked weed before then. And I really don't even know how I knew what it was kind of at that age, but maybe at least smart enough to know that. But so anyway, that's kind of when I started smoking pot, and I just, you know, it was really kind of a way to try to cover up the feelings and the hurt from others and just the feeling that I didn't matter to anybody at all. And that was the thinking that stayed in my mind pretty much through childhood until I was about 19. And like, I don't remember a lot of the order of exactly how these things happened, but then my mom didn't drink hard liquor at the time, but we did have some in the fridge, and there was another bottle I found later that was in the cabinet. And so once my mom found out that my sister and I were drinking it, she threw them out in the garbage. Well, of course, I dug them out of the garbage and I poured all the stuff out together, put it all in, you know, so I could have a stash of it. And I remember several nights just going up there and just getting drunk in my room, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, just to try to cover up for whatever pain and things that I was going through and what I felt in life. And so then shortly after, I also started stealing money out of my mom's drawer that she had money stashed in, basically so I could go buy candy at the store down the road. Eventually she got tired of that, and so she had to start locking her room. So one night I figured, well, you know, I've seen it on TV, so I get this sewing needle, and I think I can pick the lock, and so I keep trying, of course, working on it, couldn't get it, and then I hear something break, and I'm like, oh, that's not good. So the end of the needle was stuck inside, so there was no way my mom was going to get the door open again. So I took the whole door jamb apart, I took everything apart, took the handle out, trying to get it out of there, and it wouldn't come out. So I put it all back together, and I have no idea how, but I went to sleep that night. Of course, once my mom woke me up, it was a very abrupt wake-up call. She knew exactly what had happened. I don't know exactly how, but so we didn't have cameras, of course. So back in that time, I pretty much had a very long name. You know, Jason Eugene Allen Goodner, and then of course you'd add to it, you know, a few other names, which I thought all those names were my name, but I'm not going to repeat those here in church, so I'm not going to repeat them anyway. But so I know my sister and I, we fought quite a bit. That was just the norm, which, I mean, I know a lot of kids fight all the time, but I think some of our fights were pretty violent. But anyway. So, well, since I couldn't get into my mom's money to get candy, I just started stealing candy from the gas station. It was pretty much a daily occurrence, and I felt like I got pretty good at it, really. And so, I don't know, I guess they never really caught on to that. But so anyway, there was another opportunity. So I remember stealing a magazine from the, there was a store next door, so I grabbed the magazine, ran out the door, and of course the lady that worked there, she was going into work at the same time, and she knew my mom, so yeah, that didn't go so well. So I got grounded for a week. So then I started taking my bicycle part, because I needed something to do, because I couldn't go anywhere, so I took my bicycle part to repaint it, and got it all back together, and realized, well, I don't have any good handlebars. So I go up to the hardware store and get some, you know, handlebars. Well, they didn't fit, so I went back up again, and I got caught the second time, so I was grounded for a month. So even during that time, it was kind of me and a couple of friends, we'd still kind of try to break into some of the local buildings that were around there, and stealing, you know, minor things really, but really didn't matter. It started to trend. My mom really thought they were a bad influence on me, but turned out that I was the one being the bad influence. But we worked together on a lot of those things, I'm sure. And then I don't remember how I met this other kid. He was a little bit older than me, and so he showed me how to make bongs or other things that I could use to smoke weed with, and started showing me how to grow my own pot in my mom's house. So I had a whole thing set up in the attic, and so I had to, you know, I didn't have money, so I had to find some way to get what I could. So then, of course, at the same time, I remember going through my mom's attic space in the garage, and I must have had other people's stuff stored up, but there was porno magazines and weed magazines. And so anyway, I made that my little space to hide out so nobody could find me. And, you know, it was kind of my own little getaway, so it was like finally have a place, you know, of my own, I guess. So at the time, my dad lived with my Uncle Scott at my old great-grandma Clearwater's house. My dad met Julie Alexander, and so I remember meeting her and several of my future stepsisters, or two stepsisters. But I really felt left out because I was the only boy. I don't really remember the situation, but there was some major blowout that we had had, big fight, and my uncle came alongside me, and we walked up to the gas station. He went to buy me candy, and of course, you know, some might think, well, why would you reward a kid for something like that? But he knew what I needed. That that meant a lot to me because he knew I needed love. I needed somebody. I needed something. Maybe he didn't fully understand what that was at the time. So that stuck with me a lot of times. So when kids act out, it may not be just, there may be something else going on, and we need to be conscious. We need to be perceptive and understanding that this is more of a cry for help than just, I just want to be bad. So I can still remember back when I was basically getting high, drunk, or stealing things. I really wanted somebody to find me, to come rescue me, to fix my problems, to take me out of the situations and all those things. And I never could find anybody, of course. This is just more of, well, anyway. I had my aunts and uncles on my dad's side. You know, I remember spending a lot of time with them, but when we did spend time with them, I knew that they loved me and that they cared for me. So that gave me some hope. Of course, I probably really liked my Aunt Ellen because she bought my first cassette tape. I don't know if anybody's old enough to remember this, but it was LL Cool J's Radio. Maybe Aaron remembers that. Okay, so got a few out there. This is a slight tangent, I guess, but I remember on the plane, I was talking to a lady, and we were talking about the, like, different cultures, because, like, in Japan, the family is important. The community is important. Where here, I'm important. I'm number one. I need to forget about everybody else, forget about my family. I got to look out for me. I've got to be number one. And that's kind of one of those things that, you know, we can get so focused on ourselves that everybody else that's hurting that could use our help or, you know, really needs it, will go without. Well, anyway, aunts and uncles had a very important part of my life, and I really think that they're important today, of course. Of course I do, because we've got soon to be 33 nieces and nephews, so that's kind of exciting. There was a major blowout that we had between my mom and my sister, and of course, you know, there were a lot of times that we had fights and things like that. But so anyway, we called our dad, and by then, you know, he had had a house out here in Fairmount, and they said we can't live here anymore. We wanted out, and so anyway, we called him up, and he said, okay, all right. And then so he came up, pulled back in the back alley after my mom had went to work, and my grandma was in the front room, and so we just packed up everything we had, everything we could, in the back of my dad's Ford station wagon. And my mom had no idea that we had moved out. She just came home in the house, and we were gone. I never really went back. I never really talked to her. I didn't call her, if ever, really. So that really, we didn't really have a relationship for a long time. So anyway, that's when alcoholism got much worse for my mom. And really, I realized later, it was the same thing for me. We both were really heavy into more hard liquor than anything. So after that, we moved to Fairmount when I was 14. And of course, alcohol was a lot easier to come by then. We'd hang out uptown, and I could always find somebody to go up to the bar and buy me a fifth of Jack, and so I'd always have it done by the end of the night. And I still remember even trying to, you know, go and to find out anybody that I could even get beer from. You know, once they were drunk, I could go and steal their beer and whatever else. But I still remember sitting uptown, just sinking deeper and deeper into self-hatred and depression. I really wanted life to just be over with. So anyway, I met a couple other guys down the road that we would hang out, and they went to church at the time, but I really tried to do what I could to get him away from it. So I think, one, I wanted someone to get high with. Two, I had a hatred towards God. And three, I hated the people of the church. I even remember one time, I think it might have, I don't know if it was this church or in Danville, but I remember seeing people going into a church, and it was just like that instant, like, oh, just hated them. And I didn't know why at the time. I mean, there wasn't any situation in church where I got hurt or anything like that. I just had a real hatred towards God, I think. And so that went on to his people as well. So by the time I started Jamaica, I had long black hair, probably about down to here on my back, and you could see just like a small part of my face. And so I had black shoes, black pants, and black leather coat that my dad had got me. I wore out throughout high school. So in that time, of course, that was my, I guess, death metal days, where I really got heavier into more, the darker, the more satanic the music was, the more that I enjoyed it, the more I wanted it. And had a horrible temper, and everybody pretty much knew it. And I can't remember who it was, but came back and told me later, he said, you know, you never heard what you, nobody would ever hear you, but if they could hear you, they didn't want to be around for it. And so I would blow up and throw things and punch walls and doors and lockers. And that pretty much kept everybody scared of me, in a sense, or at least I felt like it, because nobody bullied me anymore. So I wanted to do everything that I could to keep people away. So in my freshman year, of course, I got kicked out for calling Miss Lau a very special name, and spent a lot of time in isolation. Did anybody else here have isolation in school or knew what isolation was? I know Aaron definitely didn't. So for you guys that don't know it, basically you got separated into just a room by yourself throughout the whole day, which for most of us, it was kind of like a badge of honor. It's like, hey, I got, you know, isolation or whatever. So it did not do what they were thinking it would do. Maybe it did for the people that were more, you know, that more acceptable, I guess, or maybe had like more friends in school. I don't know, but of course it didn't really bother me too much because my friend let me borrow his Game Boy, so to help me with my homework, you know. So once I was when I started finally working, I spent all my money on either gas or drugs, which usually gas to get the drugs. I remember spending a lot of time on the road going down, just trying to find, going to different people, different connections to try to get what we needed. And in those days, I spent a lot of time drawing, and I was really good at it. And even Miss Martin, she wanted me to pursue art as a career, but that didn't happen. But art was kind of like my outlet. It was finally something that people actually noticed me for, something good for a change. And I guess kicked out sophomore year for hitting another one of the kids in the class with a school book, nearly took out his eye. And then, of course, then the teacher tried to break it up, and I threatened him, and so that gave me even more time. And I think I was still having issues with, you know, taking caffeine pills and everything, and I think the next year is when I got kicked out for that, but I can't fully remember all of it. And then also spent a lot of time going to Danville and getting what we could, and even had a friend of mine, he got started on the crack, and I was too scared because I'd always heard these stories of the things that happened to people when they had a bad trip or a bad hit of something, and I didn't want to become a vegetable. So God kind of used that to kind of scare me from some of the heavier things, but sometimes it didn't really matter. And then I could still look back. Very often that God protected me by what I thought was gut feelings or dreams that I had had. So a lot of times in the dreams, I would... I'm getting distracted. This happened often enough that the friends that I was with, knew that if I told them to slow down, then they would slow down, or we would go somewhere else or do something different, because I would just have this moment where, like, something's going to happen and we need to change course. Or, you know, it wasn't always a bad thing necessarily, but most of the time it was. You know, it happened so often, they just knew if I said that, they'd listen. I didn't have to convince them, because they would see it for themselves, all these things that would happen, either near misses with accidents, or a lot of times even protect me from getting pulled over and going to, you know, going to jail and get in trouble and all that stuff. So of course, one night, even though I didn't really want to get into the heavier drugs, I tried acid and learned that that night I really, really liked it. And so we did everything we could to keep it going. So I remember even going back to town to try to get caffeine pills just to keep going, keep the trip going as long as I could. And it didn't really change anything. But I remember looking at my friend and just seeing his eyes were just so dark and sunken in and just looked like death. And the fact that I liked it so much and seeing the way he looked, it scared me. And so I never did pursue any more of it. I just stayed away from it altogether for that reason. So then at some point in time, I got kicked out of Votek, a machine shop, for smoking. And once I got back, finally somebody had enough sense to ask me what I enjoyed doing as a kid. Of course, it was destroying things, like taking anything that had electronics or motors in it, I would take it apart. So, and then later, you know, God started to piece all these things together. I knew that I wanted to go to college, I just didn't know where. Because I saw how my mom had to work Arby's pretty much her whole life, and Dad worked third shift, and I didn't really want that for myself. But at some point in time, my dad had come to Christ, and I don't remember exactly when that is, but it's a pretty cool story. I like to hear it, but I'm not sharing that this morning. So if you want to know, ask me later. So after I looked this morning, I finally found that Bible. This Bible. Had it on the shelf. I actually lost it several times, but I've always got it back. But in 93, Dad bought me this Bible. You know, at the time, I thought it was one of the dumbest things he could ever get me. I was like, why would you even waste your money on something like that? And, So eventually I was accepted into DeVry in Chicago. I didn't want to really waste any time, so we got it figured out. I had to get student loans for everything, for the schooling and for housing as well. So we just didn't have the money, so I had to find some way to do it. I was adamant that I'm going to college, and I don't care what it takes. You know, I knew I'd be paying for it for a long time, but... So I still had about a month left before to start college, and so I moved into my friend's house. Basically get a test to see how I did outside of the home, which wasn't really a test. It was more of I wanted to spend more time getting high, getting wasted, and doing all we could. And even at that time, I really didn't realize it, and I'm glad I didn't stay around. But he had laced a joint with heroin, and I didn't know that until later on. Of course, when people told me, they were scared to tell. They didn't want to tell me until later because they knew I'd flip. Because I was always scared to do something heavier. But unfortunately, that same friend, he was always about pushing the limits. And, well, he did overdose, and he did push the limit too far. And I just... So later, when that happened, I realized that would have been me. I still think if God wouldn't have rescued me, I'd be dead or in jail. So anyway, after about that month period, I moved on to Carroll Stream, got an apartment with a few other people and three other people. Two of the roommates, they were pretty much complete slobs, and anybody that knows me knows I like everything lined up and in its place and everything else. But so anyway, then I had one roommate, which I'm going to mention, Dusty. I don't know if you guys noticed a stranger in here, but stranger to you guys, but I haven't seen him for a long time, since I got married. And then, so it's been 27 years, I figured out this morning. So, but anyway. So anyway, he was a really good roommate and everything. I didn't really spend any time getting high during the week when I was in Chicago, because I didn't want to see what Cook County Jail was like. I didn't want to take a chance. So I was scared, so thank God for that. So God used fear quite a few times in my life to save me and to change what I was doing. So every night, Dusty would turn on to his side. He'd put his headphones on. I think it was maybe Pearl Jam at the time or something. and he would be reading. And so I didn't realize till later that he was reading his Bible at night. And so I remember that every night. Just, I can still picture the room, picture, you know, the whole scene. But anyway, it didn't really mean much of anything to me at the time. I just knew that he was doing something. And so anyway, before the end of the semester came, we found out that we were getting kicked out of the apartment because of a lot of the other things that were going on in the other side of the apartment. Because we pretty much just stayed in our room. We didn't want to go out there. And, I mean, it was nasty. And they didn't understand why. But so they had been there, what, I think even 3 years. They'd been there in school and just, you know, kept having to repeat and everything. So, but I don't think they really cared, because they had their way paid for. So anyway, we got kicked out, and so I remember going to the school, telling them, you know, Dustin and I get along really well. Could we stay roommates? And they're like, yeah, that's fine. That's true. We can do that. And so anyway, the night before we were to move out, he just simply asked me the question. He's like, do you believe in God? And I was like, well, there's got to be something out here. All this couldn't just magically happen out of nothing. You know, I mean, even though I didn't know at the time, there's just too many holes in the theory of evolution anyway. You know, and it takes a lot more faith to believe by millions and billions of chances we're here where we are, and all the things just happen by chance. That's just, to me it's ludicrous. So anyway, after we was asking this, we were talking about things, and I don't even know if the conversation lasted very long or not, but I felt a presence, kind of like a calm presence in the room. I had this kind of like a, I don't know if it really meant anything, but a tingling sensation in my back. It just felt like somebody was there, but it wasn't creepy. I wasn't worried about it. And so then after that, we went to bed. So the next morning, we get all of our stuff, took one load, got everything moved in. Dusty had to go to work, and then I had to go to work about 6, something like that. And so anyway, I got home about midnight, and normally I was coming in the door. I'd come in cussing and complaining. I was just always angry because, well, I don't know, just angry at everything still. So, anyway, I walked in, and Dusty's talking to somebody in the front room, which I thought was a complete stranger. And I didn't know this at the time, but Dusty knew him before for a brief period of time. And he needed a place to stay for the night, is what I found out later. So I went to my room, started getting ready for bed, and I felt drawn into there. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what they were talking about. I just felt like I needed to go in there. So I go in there, and he's talking about all these amazing stories of all the things that God had done in his family. And I remember him talking a lot, and I don't really remember exactly what the things Dusty was saying, but I know that I was listening to this guy really intently at some point. And so anyway, I'm just sitting there listening, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, I could explain, the only way I can explain is it felt like a rushing wind went through my entire body, and I couldn't move, I couldn't do anything, and I didn't say anything, but the guy that was telling telling me all these stories. He said he saw this burst of light, but I never saw a light. But I remember it was a very intense feeling. So right after that, we finished talking, and it was time to go to bed. So I don't know if, well, Dusty, I talked to him this morning about it. He didn't realize what had happened, and of course I wasn't really forthcoming on it, but I think I remember asking him, what do I do now? Of course, my thought was, what do I do now? Because it's like I went from being nobody and nothing to knowing that God cared for me, that God loved me, and that my whole life had changed in that second. You know, and you know, parents can love us, but parents can't love us like God can. And so it was just that instant change, and it was, I was blown away. And so, but after that, it was just, I finally felt peace for once. Finally had joy. Something I'd never experienced before. You know, because all my life I spent my time listening to Satan and his little lies about how no one cares and no one loves you. And I know there's more people that hear that than I do. Even people that are more stable than I was, or still am. But I remember it wasn't about, like, he wasn't going around telling me that I was a sinner, that I needed forgiveness, or I needed Christ as my sacrifice, and that God wanted me to experience heaven. He wanted to save me. He wanted to change me from who I was. I didn't hear those things, but it didn't matter. So when you're talking about, when God prompts you to do something, just be faithful to preach, to speak, to whatever it might be. Because I doubt Dusty knew that night, just asking me if I believed what I believed about God would matter. I mean, I know it wasn't you. I know it was God, but you saved my life by listening to God. You did what God told you to do. And so he saved me. God saved me because of what you did. So you need to be faithful. Even if you think it's so insignificant, you need to be faithful. I had a lot of those times in my life where God called me to do something, to speak to somebody on the street, and I passed it up and I ignored it, and I felt terrible for it. And eventually got to the point where it's like, I don't care, fine. You tell me to do it, I'm going to do it. And so that's a whole another tangent. Well, anyway, the next day, either it was testing that had come, or it was just God showing me himself. So I get up and I start heading back down 294 in Chicago on my way back home, and I really felt I needed to pull over. Something's not right. So I pulled over, got out, walked around the front, and three of the five lug nuts, well, even posts, were sheared off completely. There was nothing there. So in my, you know, 4 hour sleep deprived mind, I thought I could get back on the interstate going 45, the minimum, at least get to the next exit, to Cicero exit. So I get back on there, and I was like, no, this isn't right. So I pull over to the side of the road, and I'm going down the shoulder about 35, and there goes the tire and rim flying off the car. And just, it went perfectly straight. And I remember getting out of the car, and I went back to the trunk. And I remember hearing some yelling, and there was a lady, at least one lady, maybe two, out. They were just outside. They happened to be outside at break. It was a wheelchair warehouse. So anyway, they're hauling it at me, so I go down to the bottom of the hill, and there was my tire and rim next to the hole in the fence. And so they're like, hey, you can come in, use our phone. So I told my dad, I said, I'm done with drugs, I'm done with alcohol, I'm done with all that. That part of my life is over. I still wish I could have seen how he reacted at that time. But anyway, so we got that. We did get the car fixed, and it was about 12 hours to get home that day. And so I, on one of my stops, I stopped at my sister's house on the way to tell her everything that had happened. And, you know, eventually I told all my friends about what happened. And, of course, I always had the same result, just a blank stare of, who are you? Who is this? This isn't you. And even one of them told me later, he's like, you're the last person I ever thought would ever be a Christian. You know, and so anyway, after I left my sister's house, I was going down the back road on 45, and I just really had the sense I need to let off the gas. And just, I need to slow down. So I let off the gas, and a deer just went running across in front of the car, and I kind of, I guess, burst out laughing and crying at the same time, because it was like God was showing me that was me all those times. You thought it was a gut feeling. You thought it was some intuition or something. That was me protecting you all that time. So I started to, at some point in time after that, I started taking inventory of everything that I had and started going through everything and just saying, this is garbage, this is garbage. I'm throwing this away, I'm throwing that away. And I got rid of all my pipes and bongs and all the other stuff that I'd made, and paraphernalia and alcohol, magazines. Because at one time I was like, well, I could give this to so-and-so. I'm like, no, I don't want to give that away. I'm going to trash it. You know, so I didn't want to just keep passing on what I'd, you know, passing it along. So anyway, unfortunately, that I didn't really quit quite as quick as I said I was going to. So anyway, even that very weekend, the next night, I went to my friend's house to get high, and so I did, and I really didn't feel good. I really didn't feel right. Something wasn't right at all. And so I started heading home, and I started freaking out on the way home, thinking I'm going to die. And I'm just like, Lord, please just let me get home to family at least. You know, if I die tonight, fine. I just want to be home. So anyway, I get home, of course, calm down. Everything was fine. I mean, God was using panic attacks at that time, for sure. Well, unfortunately, it happened two more times. Two more weekends in a row that I went through that, and I said, all right, God, I'm done. I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore. You know, God was holding me to my promises that I had made to him and to my dad. So even right after that time, I got this book, Bible, that I thought my dad was a complete fool for buying me. I finally got it out and started reading it. Every day, constantly reading it. I mean, it was just like I couldn't get enough, because I wanted to find out who God was. I wanted to find out how much he loved me. I wanted to know what does he expect of me? Because, I mean, if I'm going to live for somebody, I want to know everything I can about him. So, I mean, it really kept blowing me away about how much is in the Word and how much strength we get by it. And when we don't read it, we open ourselves up to really demonic attack, because we don't have power on our own. I think that's one of the biggest problems that we have, is we think we have the power to deliver ourselves from drugs, or deliver ourselves from alcohol, or deliver ourselves from depression, or deliver ourselves from all these things. We have to take the work. We have to do the work to be free from those things, but God is the one that ultimately saves us. He's the one that will change it. And if it doesn't change from the inside, the only thing we're dealing with is symptoms. We can't just try to fix symptoms. It's never going to work. We're just going to revert back and keep going back to the same thing until God deals with the heart of the issue. So after that, I just remember, you know, having so much peace to be able to walk in peace and everything that I went through. And so about a year or two after I got out of school, graduated and ended up moving back down here, and I just kind of got in the stage where I started becoming more angry at God, and debts were piling up, and loans were coming in where I had to start paying them, and I had made mistakes in Chicago when, you know, I swore I'd never had a credit card, and then I got one, and the car broke down like 5 or 6 different times. I had to keep going, just all these things, and everything just piled up, and I couldn't pay my bills. And so I kept working my normal job, and then I tried to work at night until midnight so I could at least find some way to pay it, and I couldn't really do that. And, you know, God did work things out through that, of course, but I remember I started smoking again, I started getting back into drinking, and I started, you know, smoking pot again, and just all the different things. And I was acting like a spoiled child because God didn't give me everything that I wanted. And I thought, I think maybe in the back of my mind I had this idea that now that I know God, everything's going to be perfect. I'm not going to have any problems. I'm going to, you know, God is just going to grant me whatever. I mean, I don't remember believing that, but that's the way I was acting. It's like, you know, you're not giving me everything I want, so I'm going to throw a fit, and I'm going to hurt myself to hurt you, God. It was kind of one of those things, because I remember even when I started smoking again, it was hard to actually smoke. It was hard for me, but I was like, I'm going to push through this. It's like, I'm going to show you, God, you know, by hurting myself kind of thing. And so this was early on when I first started at Frasca, and I didn't have insurance yet. But at the time, I started developing a lump underneath my arm. And so I remember for a good portion of the time, I basically would just kind of walk around with my arm out because I didn't want to put pressure on it. It just hurt. And I really wasn't all that worried about it. But the day that I had insurance was the day I had my first doctor's appointment. So anyway, I go to the doctor, and he's like, okay, well, I want you to go see this other guy. So I'm like, okay, whatever, you know. So I go to the other doctor, and I go to the clinic, where the doctor was at. And so I go up the elevator, and I look over, and I saw his name, the doctor's name, with cancer specialist next to it. It's just kind of one of those moments where you say, "Oh, okay, all right, okay. Well, maybe this is more serious." So anyway, probably got even more anxious when I got in there, and he said, we don't want to pull fluid from it because we're afraid that it would spread. So anyway, after asking me a lot of different questions and going through things, you know, he said, we need to have surgery. We need to open it up to see what it is. And so anyway, after the appointment was over, I went out to my car, and I said, God, I am done. I'm not running anymore. You have all of me. Take what you want. I'm done running. I'm not doing this anymore. And again, I had that peace back. And even that night, I don't even know how exactly it worked out, but I found out that they were having revival services here at the church. And so I came here that whole week, and they prayed for me. And so anyway, it turned out I had surgery, and they turned out to be nothing really to worry about. And when I went back to have the drain tube removed, the nurse, she's like, I don't remember exactly how she said it, but she's like, she believed it was divine intervention because the doctor was certain it was lymphoma. But I wanted to share that story because even though I had come to Christ, I still wasn't allowing him to have my life. It's like, I'm in control. This is my life. You can have my main part, but these are mine. And that's not how the Lord works. He wants all of you. He wants your whole heart. And the more you fight and fight against it, the worse things get, the harder life gets. Because God loves you and he cares for you. He's going to do what needs to be done to bring you to himself. Yeah. Well, you know, I figured out that I seem to fail the most when I fail to go back to my first love. You know, when I first loved him. Do I love him the way I did when he saved me that night? And I asked my I have that question in my mind a lot of times. Do I still love him like that? And that's what God really wants, is he wants you to love him like you did the first time that you knew him. And if you don't have that, ask him for it. I don't know how many times I have had to ask a lot. God, bring back that first love, because I can't seem to do it on my own. Anyway, so obviously I still have a long way to go, and so God's still working on me. And then Romans 8:28, it says that we know that God causes all things to work together for the good of those who love God, comma, to those who are called to his purpose. You know, it still amazes me. I didn't love God, but he was still doing his purpose in my life all that time, even when I rejected him, even when I hated him, or even hated the thought of him. And then also Proverbs 3:5-6 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. I think sometimes we try to get his direction without following his leading. But so for last of all, it's Romans 10:13. It says, whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. If you desire to know him, now is the time to call on him. I don't know how much time you have left. None of us know how much time we have left. I could walk down the steps and be the end of my life. We don't know. I'm not trying to put that fear in there, but I remember when I, earlier on, and I still feel the same way, I cared about going to heaven, but I wasn't worried about seeing what heaven was going to be like. I just wanted to be in his presence, and that's still all I want to see. I just can't wait to be in his presence. With all he's done for me, how could I want anything else? Mike has a song that just to play at the end, and once the song is over, dismissed.